Okay, let's convene the 2 o'clock Thursday, December 1st council meeting. Carla, please call the roll.
Novick?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Hales? Saltzman?
Here. If you could please read our first agenda item.
Item 1334, accept the State of Housing in Portland 2016 report.
Well, I will go ahead and kick things off here. Pleased to present the second annual State of Housing report put together by the Portland Housing Bureau and just released this week. And it's an effort to truly capture the state of housing affordability across our city. And today we'll have a presentation from the Housing Bureau on this report. And I will just state that the report compiles market data on neighborhoods across the city and gives us an in-depth analysis of that data in order to evaluate the progress we've made towards our shared affordable housing goals. The data within the 2016 report indicates that housing affordability in Portland in the last year has gotten worse. We know that this is an issue that disproportionately impacts low-income residents, communities of color, seniors, and individuals with disabilities. As a council, we have taken incredible steps over this past year to increase and diversify the funding sources and tools we have to build and preserve affordable housing throughout our city. And I'd just like to take a moment to revisit and highlight a few of those steps. As a council, we voted to increase the funds dedicated to affordable housing in our urban renewal areas from 30% to 45%. We released a $62 million solicitation for affordable housing proposals, the largest ever in the city's history. We established a construction excise tax dedicated to affordable housing and dedicated revenue from the lodging taxes of short-term rentals to affordable housing development and production. We all advocated tirelessly to lift the preemption on inclusionary zoning, and we've worked hard over the past 8 months gathering input and crafting an inclusionary housing program that we will have a hearing on next week. And our community has rallied around the issue of affordable housing, and together we passed a $258 million general obligation bond measure, the first bond measure in the city's history dedicated to affordable housing. We currently have almost 2,000 units, affordable housing units, in the pipeline. And by in the pipeline, I mean either being permitted or in construction. And I expect that number to increase significantly in the coming years. With all of our great work being done to address the affordable housing crisis in our city, we must not lose sight of the reason why we do this work: to see true economic diversity in all of our neighborhoods, to ensure that families can live in the same city that they work, and to make certain that longtime residents of our city that live on fixed incomes still have a safe and comfortable place to live when they retire. This is the Portland we want to see, and together this is the Portland we are working towards. I want to give a special thank you to all of the Housing Bureau staff who worked on this report. It truly is a team effort to put together such a detailed report, and I'd particularly like to recognize Matthew Schibold, who took the vision for this report to the incredibly informative document that it has become. And I'll now turn it over to Matthew Schibold and Kurt Krieger to present the highlights of the report.
Good afternoon.
Before you do that, I just want to mention one last thing, sort of some breaking news. I'd also like to note that yesterday the Housing Bureau closed on the first ever city mobile home park preservation effort. I'm pleased to let you know that the Oak Leaf Mobile Home Park is now in nonprofit ownership. There are many steps to come, including upgrading the park, but this is a huge milestone, and I'd like to thank everyone at Portland Housing Bureau, especially Javier Mena, for navigating this new and unfamiliar territory while also keeping in the mind the best interests of the Oak Leaf residents. So just wanted to get that breaking news out there.
Congratulations, and thank you so much from all of us.
Thank you.
Fabulous.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Salzman, for the introduction. Members of council, my name is Kirk Krieger. I'm privileged to be your housing director, and with me today is Matthew Scheibold, who is both policy and equity manager for the Housing Bureau. I would like to underscore the fact that this is very much a team effort, and it consumes the work of 17 different people within the Housing Bureau. I'd like to recognize Antoinette Pietka, who is the team leader, Victoria James, the project manager, David Sheeran, and Bimal Rajbandari, who are both analysts that support both Annette and Victoria, and Martha Calhoun, our public information officer, who reads this to make sure that we don't descend into too much jargon, make sure that it still makes sense for the common person in Portland. So would you please stand up, the team that I just recognized? So housing for us, of course, is 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and Commissioner Salzman has given you some highlights that are mentioned in further detail in the executive summary. The last 14 months have been momentous. For people outside of Portland, I often describe this as a housing renaissance, a housing policy renaissance, and that is we have challenges, but we've also, as a city, responded forcefully and creatively to those challenges. And one way that I characterize this is that it was time to call the question. That is, members of council, you are used to public process, public debate, but there's a moment in time when you know enough to make a decision. And I'd like to say that in this last year, you've called the question time and time again and collectively have mobilized new resources and provided new assets to help address the housing emergency. It is very much an opportunistic effort, and from the outside, it may look somewhat chaotic because we don't have a strategic plan and a strategic framework by which we are taking this action, unlike some cities who have put great effort into the plan and less effort into the implementation. We've turned this around and focused on implementation first and have backfilled the strategy with policy where we need to. Seattle's Housing Affordability and Livability Agenda is a good case in point, where we have accomplished most of what Mayor Murray has set out in the Housing Affordability and Livability Agenda without proclaiming the agenda. And that's a tactical choice on our part because some of our measures required state legislative action, and we didn't want to broadcast, advertise, show our hand, if you will, where we were going. But we have, I think, accomplished a great deal. Denver, same story. They've just come forward with a new five-year plan. It required, of course, a great deal of effort on the part of the city council. There was actually a countermeasure proposed by the president of the council. It was quite fractious, but they are now moving forward with some of the things, same things that we've already done. So I want to congratulate you for acting quickly with measured and reasonable action. The actions that are mentioned, of course, the housing and homelessness emergency. Even places like Los Angeles and the LA Times asked me what difference the housing emergency has made, because they, of course, have declared a state of housing emergency in Los Angeles. The press can't tell what difference it has made. So I'm able to point to several actions where tangible resources have resulted from your declaration of action, including code amendments and siting standards for emergency shelters. Of course, we made available some $62 million for new housing resources in the last year. That was an unprecedented increase in available resources, and it also merged county land, county general fund resources, as well as properties of PDC and the Housing Bureau in a creative collaboration that yielded several hundred new sites. You increased tax increment financing for housing, and we'll come back later in the next 2 weeks with a TIF lift strategy. Working together with Multnomah County, you increased the tax abatement resources from $1 million to $3 million. You adopted the first step in additional tenant protections, which was ultimately upheld by action of the state legislature, and you've dedicated short-term rental revenues to affordable housing production and preservation. I might add that many cities are still debating whether or not to even tax short-term rentals. We're there, we've led the way, and many people look at Portland as an example. Of course, we were disciplined, focused and successful with the state legislature by working the 32 days out of the 35-day session to get the inclusionary zoning prohibition lifted after some 17 years, and worked diligently for over 6 months on the intergovernmental agreement with the chair of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners to create the Joint Office of Homeless Services. As mentioned by Commissioner Saltzman, you enacted August 1st effectively a construction excise tax, which inures to a housing investment fund, which is tapping the hydraulics of the private market with respect to commercial, industrial, and residential development to help provide offsetting resources for people otherwise priced out of Portland. And of course, voters were given the prospect of the largest ever capital investment, a housing, affordable housing bond, which was resoundingly supported, approving some $258.4 million for capital resources, which will be allocated in the next 5 years and spent within 7 years.
Could you remind me what the total amount of the construction excise tax is supposed to,
It's estimated to be a $10 million, approximately, up to 10.
For you.
So if we took, what we did is we took the last 10 years' worth of permitting data in the categories that we had the authority to levy the tax and averaged it out, and I would offer that it also included the recessionary years, and if we had had the tax in the previous decade, it would have averaged $8 million per year.
And then lastly, as you know, having just held a study session on the matter of inclusionary housing, next Thursday you will hold a public hearing, and you will hear hours of testimony from both opponents and proponents for whether or not inclusionary housing is a good idea. We think it's a great idea whose time is long overdue. You know, Montgomery County, Maryland enacted inclusionary housing in 1979. They have over 13,000 units of affordable housing available in suburban Bethesda, places like outside of Washington, D.C. and Montgomery County. Fairfax, Virginia instituted it somewhat later, 26 years ago, and they have about 8,000 units of housing currently in service. So in 20 years, we should see similar numbers. But having not been able to implement this tool in, for the last two or three business cycles, we have a little catching up to do. So that's the good news. If you were to say the good, the bad, and the ugly, I'd like to say that all the news was good. In fact, it's not. Some of it is quite grim for the people that are struggling with housing affordability. In terms of production, we have increased the pipeline of affordable rental housing production by 400 units in the last year. Of those 1,900 units, we have a good distribution of units across the income spectrum, some 354 units under 30% of the area median, 324 between 30 and 50, 1,000 units under 60% of median income, and some 245 units up to 80%, which are provided through tax exemptions, not through direct financing. We've been able to assist some 700 existing homeowners with housing repair loans and grants, and provided short-term rental assistance to over 4,000 households, provided permanent supportive housing for some 3,900 households, assisted 1,900 households with transitional housing, and have supported 4,600 emergency shelter beds.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, sir.
The 1,900 units in the production pipeline is an astonishing number, particularly you look at in the report about the historical production. So congratulations. And over half of them are at 60%, which I think is really noteworthy. But less than 5 are at 30%. And the disconnect for me is that the folks we want to get from shelter to short-term housing to apartments need those 30% units. So what is your takeaway about prospects looking forward to boosting our production at 30%?
Well, and the last slide, which I was planning on going into some great detail on, but as we configured the $258.4 million general obligation bond issue, we put a special emphasis on 0 to 30 households that were not able to assist with the normal flow of funds through tax increment and other resources. And moreover, we weren't getting large units per se, since a lot of our programs are tapped to tap the hydraulics of the private market through things like tax exemptions. We're getting smaller units. So we're getting family-sized units in large proportion through the bond, and we're getting more 0 to 30 in percent income units. We're able to do that because there's, of course, no debt to be paid on the properties that we acquire with bond revenues. We do plan on leveraging some additional resources from HUD through their various rehabilitation loan programs, but we don't expect those properties to have to carry a mortgage, so we can help more people between 0 and 30%.
So that's a great answer, and I think what it tells the community is you've taken the tax abatement program and really pushed it, but those don't get typically to 0 to 30. You've taken the tax. We boosted the amount of urban renewal money, but without Section 8 vouchers and subsidies, we don't get usually to 0 to 30. The bond gives us that opportunity, and we got to prepare people for the fact that if we're going to provide that housing to people at 0 to 30, which to put the human face on it, as Dan often does, full-time minimum wage workers, an older adult on SSI, a formerly homeless family, they're going to be slightly more expensive because they have to come with a subsidy. But if we don't tackle that problem, then all the good work that you're doing at the bottom of this slide about getting people into shelter and to transitional housing falls short because we have a bottleneck, unless we have the units that they can move into permanently. So I appreciate that answer.
There's another thing I'd like to mention about the pipeline. We discussed one of the policy imperatives of inclusionary housing at the study session on Tuesday, and we talked about permanent affordability at 99 years. We've, of course, been through tax increment buying affordability at 60 years. We plan on migrating all of the policies towards a permanent solution. In other words, we don't think it's fair to compel a private developer to include affordable units for 99 years and not hold our nonprofit and other for-profit partners to the same standards. So we're going to gradually go to a 99-year standard across the board. So we'll be buying longer-term affordability. So we do look at the overall multifamily and single-family production citywide, and in the calendar year of 2015, we saw some 4,500 units permitted and 3,700 units. And I think, and Mayor Hales, I think, would flag this if were he here, it is remarkable that most of that is happening in the Central City. Portland can be very proud of its transportation policies and its land use policies yielding the effect that you all as council members have decided you wanted, which is to focus on location efficiency. So the market has responded. We're seeing good, solid growth in the Central City, as you can see from slide 6, which describes the physical location of these units across the city. Of course, we're tracking in real time the 2016 pipeline, and we, as mentioned earlier at the study session, are seeing approximately 15,000 units today in the permit pipeline, which would be a tripling, if you will, of past year's practice. On the single family side, of course, more than 60% of the city is zoned single family, as you well know, having gone through the comprehensive plan exercise and being in the thick of the rezoning process now. Some 800 units have been permitted and over 700 units produced. So even for a city that is arguably mature, we're still seeing quite a lot of single-family production. And as you can see, a lot of that is occurring in the North End neighborhoods, MLK in Alberta, significant amount in the Lentz Foster and interstate corridors. Insofar as rental affordability, of course, we spend a lot of time working on rental affordability because those are the households that are the most vulnerable. Low-wage workers spending, on average, about 80% of their income on rent to afford a fair market rent unit in Portland if they can find one. So over the year, rents increased some 7% in 2015. 3% for studios, about 12.5% for one bedrooms, nearly 20% for two bedrooms, and 15% for three bedrooms. That, of course, is not a sustainable trend. And it is probably contributed more to the statewide debate about rent stabilization than any other single measure. We've modeled the effect of the minimum wage increases on low-wage earners, and there is a bend of the cost curve if and only if landlords don't take the entire wage increase in the form of higher rents. And I think that's an open policy question which we'll want to monitor in the future.
Kurt, we talk about households that are rent burdened. How do you define rent burden, and what's the current statistic that the Housing Bureau uses?
Well, rent and burden, for those of you that don't live in this world, are if a household pays more than one-third of their income on rent and utilities, they are deemed to be rent burdened. And we're currently, and I want to turn to Matthew because I know it's in here, I believe that we're well over 40%, but I think we're actually over 50%.
50% in terms of?
Rent burden.
So about 22 to 23,000 households in Portland continue to pay more than 30% of their income, or of their income toward the toward housing costs, and we would consider them rent burdened.
That's out of what, 160,000 households?
So that's specific to renter households. So around 150,000 households. Yeah.
The so it's something we continue to monitor quite closely, as obviously geographically people are disadvantaged, often forced to travel further and further away from their work. You know, one slide that it's not here, but it is on page 11. It's like, who are Portland's renters? I found this graphic to be an interesting sort of digestion of a lot of statistics. And one statistic which really caught my eye is that 59% of Portland renters get to work by car. So for all of the great transportation work that we've done and all the equitable TOD that we've done, people's jobs are often not in close proximity to where they live. They have other reasons to need a car, i.e. their kids have to be dropped off to school or daycare on their way to work. They may even have two jobs that are in different parts of town. So rent burden is one issue, but of course the cost of transportation is a serious matter, and we only see oil prices going up these days, not going down. So that population is going to be increasingly stressed. As they have moved to the edges of the city to qualify, they have encumbered themselves with transportation costs that are not sustainable. And I fear that we're going to see yet more stresses on those households as they are forced to double up or triple up to help maintain their quality of life. So we looked specifically at neighborhood affordability and the change of neighborhood affordability. And on slide 10, you can see a quick extract. You know, for the median three-person low-income household earning some $39,720 per year, there are two fewer neighborhoods affordable to them in 2016 than there were in 2015. And as you can see, for the three-person moderate-income household, somewhat higher at about $53,000, four neighborhoods fell out of affordability. Slide 11 talks about owner affordability. And, of course, people that own homes can celebrate the increased home equity, but based on the resident satisfaction survey of the city auditor, of course, people are troubled by this because they themselves know people who are stressed having to pay increased housing prices or have household members, family members, children that cannot afford to live in the city. So median home prices increased some 44% from 2011 to 2015. It's not evenly shared across the city. The low-cost communities of Lentz and Foster saw nearly 80% increase in values. Interstate and Gateway about 62%, 59% in St. John's, and 57% in the 122nd and Division area. Now, overall, our median home price is now top $400,000 in over half the neighborhoods. So the $500,000 house is a fleeting rarity in Portland, and we look at these trends with great concern because obviously folks that are pushed to the very edges of the city, if not out of the county and out of the state entirely as they manage their own budgets and try to find affordable housing.
Kurt, can I ask you a question off this
slide?
Yes, sir.
Do you have a sense of sort of in order what are the forces, market forces driving this? So, for example, we hear about people moving here with resources bidding up property. We hear about historically low inventory, and therefore it's a good time to be a seller. And we know that we've been in a kind of a sweet spot with interest rates where you can leverage an awful lot of money given historically low interest rates. And there may be other factors. Do you have a sort of a sense of how you rank those and what are the principal drivers?
Well, it is a combination of all of the above. The best analogy I can think of is, you know, we're the cheapest house on an expensive block. You know, we have Seattle to the north, San Francisco to the south. Businesses and residents are making location decisions based on some real black and white facts. So they can compare Seattle home ownership, which is significantly more costly than here. They can compare it in the Bay Area. And frankly, if they are a well-trained worker, they can work just about any place. So we are seeing in-migration of highly educated people finding work in advanced technology, advanced manufacturing, healthcare, and education. That's great news because we have a dynamic, well-educated workforce. But they're also competing with existing folks who are in less well-paid jobs for an inventory that is constrained, supply constrained. I don't know that, you know, I'm not a supply side aficionado. Some people argue that if you just had more product, it would be cheaper and therefore more available. But I'm reminded that bungalows that cost less than $3,000 when they were built in the early 1900s are now trading at well over $500,000. So filtering occurs either up or down the income spectrum. Filtering means the next household that moves into that unit is either a higher income household or a lower income household. And if they are a higher income household, they are filtering up. And if they're a lower income household, they're filtering down. Of course, Detroit, parts of East St. Louis, places elsewhere in the Midwest are filtering down. We happen to be filtering up. So even the 123,000 new households that you have accommodated in the comp plan accommodates projected growth. It doesn't do anything to change that dynamic. So I think the supply is going to be a constrained supply for quite some time. I don't see that changing in the next two business cycles. there's quite a lot of literature about, you know, how much does it take to actually reduce the price. And I can tell you that I worked in Phoenix in 2008 to 2012, and they saw a virtual market collapse. The median values dropped 65%. But there aren't enough lenders in this town, nor is there enough capital in this town to cause that kind of market collapse to occur. Nor, given our fine-grained detail of residential development, are you likely to see a developer produce that kind of product causing the market to shift. So we're going to have continued supply problems. I think it's going to be largely in the most location-efficient areas, which is a bit of a tragedy for low-income people because they will be forced to assume higher cost of transportation and perhaps accept inferior schools than what they could otherwise find in Portland. Owner affordability, we do describe those neighborhoods that have fallen out of affordability. As you can see, three-person low-income households could afford more house in East Portland than they can this year. We lost two neighborhoods in the last one-year cycle, and three-person moderate-income households lost as well. We looked at renter affordability for communities of color, and this is probably the most profound and systemic trend, and that is that black households were of course locked out of Portland last year. This year, Latino households have lost ground and are basically on the same footing as African American households have been. White households and Asian households are closely tracking to the median and therefore still have some affordability available to them, but less than before. So as we grapple with what we want in the way of a socially equitable and inclusive community, we have to recognize that we're working against type, we're working against some macroeconomic trends here. And of course, we're not alone. Other metro areas have seen the suburbanization of racial minorities. Washington, D.C., most profoundly, has now been is no longer a majority-minority community, but the suburbs in and around Washington, D.C. are. And I'm afraid that that trend is continuing here as rapidly as it has been there. Ownership affordability for communities of color is similarly constrained. There's no real good news to report in that regard, I regret to say. So, as I said, the council has called the question, and you've taken some tough votes, and I thank you for your cohesion and your clear-headed vision about what needs to happen. There are several next steps that we want to highlight for you, because we don't see our work as being anywhere close to being done, even though we have more resources than ever before. The implementation of the general obligation bond and your appointment of five members to a bond oversight committee are quite important this winter. We will be bringing forward an interim credit facility that we intend to activate with the Office of Finance so that we can begin acquiring residential real estate for the bond.
Kurt or Dan, could you remind us, I seem to recall under the bond, each member of council nominates or proposes someone. When do you anticipate collecting names and then bringing something to council?
Well, I was hoping to get that process underway in the next, this month, December. Yeah.
Okay. So it's a five-member oversight committee, and the chair is appointed by the commissioner in charge of housing, and each of you has an appointee to designate. They are looking at expenditures,
Before you go on, just about the nomination process, is there any thought to waiting until the two new members of council can designate a person on the oversight committee?
Yes, there is. Yes.
And following up on that point, I am a fan of providing the authority of the council to each member to nominate someone. The flaw in that process sometimes is tracking the overall composition of the committee and making sure that it's broadly representative. So you could have a situation where you have five people thinking about, maybe equity or racial disparities, but then there isn't, other voices. So I would welcome at the appropriate time a conversation about how do we filter the nominations and ultimately make sure that we have a body of five that's broadly representative. And in that spirit, one of the things we're doing in our office is composing a list of 1A, 1B, and 1C, anticipating we'll have a conversation about what does the whole look like, but have our short list.
That's great. Yeah, I think overcome that practice, Commissioner, I think mine has been I'm going to wait to the last as the Commissioner in charge to see who my colleagues have nominated, and then tracking are they diverse in geography, age, background, et cetera.
I would like to mention something in this regard as it pertains to social equity and inclusion, and that is that the Welcome Home Coalition, of course, it's hundreds of people and organizations that devoted their time and talent to getting the voter-approved bond passed. Five members, of course, comes nowhere close to representing the variety of interests. So as a bureau, we need to make sure that the stakeholders are heard as we work through issues such as minority and women-owned disadvantaged small business contracting for development as well as for maintenance of properties that are acquired through this measure. So, I've committed to the coalition that we will have a process that is inclusive. We think we can reach some, not just fulfill some housing goals, but also address some of our social equity goals through the implementation of the bond. As we discussed on Tuesday at the study session, the mandatory inclusionary housing is coming forward. In due time, it will be implemented. You will decide the proper calibration of offsets. and we're fully confident that you'll have the information necessary to make an informed decision. It is momentous, and while it won't apply to developments that are vested prior to the February 1st deadline, I am reminded that all the projects that are currently investing will be paying a construction excise tax if they pull their permits and when they pull their permits. So those funds will inure to the Housing Investment Fund. They will be used for offsets, and the program will be then, I think, self-sustaining over a long period of time. I can't wait for the hearing. You know, I think 2 p.m. on Thursday, for those people that are watching this at home, I think it'll be a good example of the plethora of interests here in the city of Portland, both advocates and for-profit developers, all of whom are instrumental in creating a community that we care about.
Can I ask you or the commissioner in charge just to remind us, does the, for those people that are trying to beat the deadline and get under the gun, do they have to, do they satisfy that requirement by simply filing for a permit, or does a permit have to issue?
They can file the complete design review application. So it has to be a state of completion for them to...
That gets them vested.
They're vested upon filing if it's complete? Okay, so...
The good news for the architects and engineers of Portland, since they're all working overtime to help satisfy that demand. And I am comforted...
At this rate, there may not be any land to develop. I mean, we have to...
I am comforted that the aggressive goals that you have in the comprehensive plan will not at all be stifled by inclusionary zoning. If anything, we've actually accelerated the throughput of the permits to meet the goals that you've established.
Well, and my understanding, Dan, is that we're also trying to structure this inclusionary housing proposal so that it's attractive enough for people to voluntarily participate.
Yes.
So the folks that are sort of getting ahead of the implementation date still might look at this as having enough value that they voluntarily participate.
That's true.
We believe many will. That once higher interest rates are taken into consideration, that some of the developers that are vested under the old rules will look at the voluntary program. We will make available the 10% at 60% option to them and discuss with them the property tax abatement as an offset. If they're in North Portland, we'll also be discussing how the preference policy will apply to the property going forward. So, you know, I think we'll have time to do that. And we are recognizing that any system requires a bit of an adjustment. We've been very transparent and open about the changes, and people are hedging their bets by investing their resources now to get their projects permitted, but they may well choose to include affordable housing. And we'll be ready for them when they want to negotiate a particular voluntary program. Process improvements are quite important, and I don't want to underestimate the value of the governmental accountability and transparency review that Mayor Hales and Commissioner Saltzman have initiated. Our goal was to reduce the throughput time so that as we increase funding for affordable housing, that we also shorten the review time. And we are seeing tangible results in that regard. That is an ongoing evolutionary process that really never should stop. It should always be constantly challenging the directors, in this case, Bureau of Development Services, PBOT, Transportation, myself, and others, including our utilities, PPNL and PGE, to ensure that projects are actually processed and approved in a timely manner. In the upcoming budget process, we will have a robust conversation about what ought to be included in a robust landlord-tenant services office, and we will come forward with a budget request that will be fee-supported, not general fund-supported, for rental registration and inspections. We fully expect additional tenant protections to be a lively debate, and we have state recommended standards that you will take up as a full council when Martha Pellegrino and the Office of Governmental Relations comes to brief you on that in the next week. As mentioned earlier, we have engaged in the community, North Northeast Portland, the Interstate URA, Gateway, Lentz, and are coming back to you with some policy guidance. which conforms to a budget note that you enacted on the increase of TIF. We call it the TIF lift, and that is the marginal increase of tax increment financing in those open urban renewal areas. So you'll have a chance to see that and discuss it at length with staff. And we do look forward to working with governmental relations on a robust state as well as federal legislative agenda. We know our work is cut out for us in that regard. We have new legislators both at the state and at the federal level, and obviously we have some a new administration to work with at the federal level. And then last, and certainly not least, the building on the current partnership with Multnomah County for the successful implementation of the Joint Office of Homeless Services is quite profound, and it should take and will take a significant amount of time in the upcoming year. So that's a preview of what we think are the next steps to respond to this continuing housing emergency.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, great report. Did you have anything you wanted to add, Matthew? Okay. Well, let's see if
Matthew's worn out.
Yeah, I'm sure he is worn out. Well, thanks again to the Housing Bureau and all the staff for doing a great job on this report. Do we have people signed up to testify?
Yes, we have two people, Lightning Watchdog PDX and Ruth Adkins.
Okay, well, come on up. It's just a second here. Welcome. If you just give us your name and you each have 3 minutes. We'll start with you, Mr. Lightning.
Okay. Yes, my name is Lightning. I represent Lightning Watchdog PDX. I thought the report was very detailed. I thought it was a very good report. I'll just add a few things of my own to the report. Again, my major concern, again, is focusing on the 30% and below median income. I think we're beginning to really do that with the bond implementation that was approved, and to really begin to focus on that area. Again, I'm looking at the chronic homeless. I'm looking at people who have serious drug addictions that, to me, they should be at the top of the list on getting into housing to not only provide a more safe place to live, but also to work and enable them on their addictions to live a safer, more prosperous, better, healthier life, and understand the effects that their addictions do have on them, the neighborhoods, the people around them, and begin to understand that the people in the community are looking out for them and want to make them more healthier and feel safer where they live. Again, I want to commend you, Commissioner Saltzman, on your bond. That's a historic victory. I want to say another thing on the bond. I want, again, focus on when you buy seasoned apartment units, say you were planning on buying, say, 350 units. Again, I want the property taxes on the seasoned units to continue to be paid. I think we'll have plenty of operating income. I want the property tax revenue to go back into the general fund and be dispersed among the bureaus. There's no reason to have that much operating revenue in those type of properties when they're debt-free. And, again, those are on the seasoned properties purchased in relatively good condition. Again, I would like you to have a discussion with President-elect Trump. And what I would like you to discuss is that every city that does get an affordable housing bond, I would like him to match dollar for dollar on that housing bond. I'd like him to look at that very close. There's nobody that's been elected as a president who knows more about housing, building housing, development, financing than President-elect Trump. We need to get in there first, get in the discussions first, show respect, and put it together like you did the bond, which is historic. Now deal with President-elect Trump and put that together, a dollar-for-dollar match on any city that can get these type of bonds in place. And again, that's a historic thing you've done, and I commend you on your efforts, and people will see the results in the next few years that will be game-changing in this city. So thank you for your efforts.
Thank you. Ruth?
Thanks so much. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Ruth Adkins. I'm with Oregon Opportunity Network. We're a statewide association of affordable housing and community development nonprofits. I just wanted to come and thank you for this really important report and for shining the light on the affordability crisis and the stark racial disparities, the ones that are unacceptable and worsening in our city, both for rental housing and also for homeownership opportunity. I really want to thank the Housing Bureau staff and Commissioner Saltzman and his staff for their outstanding work on this report, as well as for, of course, all the initiatives that have been coming and are continuing to move through this council. I do want to take a quick opportunity to ask you to adopt not only the mandatory inclusionary housing proposal that's coming to you next week, but also that ask you to affirm and move forward with the residential infill project, which will add additional important new tools to our response to the housing emergency across the spectrum. So again, this report paints a dismal picture for housing opportunity in Portland, but I thank you for shining the spotlight and keeping up the pressure to move forward boldly on multiple fronts to ensure that all Portlanders have a safe, decent, and affordable place to call home. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Move to accept the report.
Okay, moved and seconded to accept the report. Please call the roll.
Novick.
And thank you very much for the encouraging and frightening report you have delivered and for your explanation. Thank you. Yeah, aye.
Ritz.
Once again, this is very important information. If we don't know the numbers, then we can't be continuing to work on changing them. So thank you for your work. Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman. I was, like you, particularly struck that 59% of renters drive their car to work. And so I think that's something that we're going to have to remember, that means that only 39% of renters actually are able to use transit or walk or bicycle. And we've got to plan for that at the same time as looking at housing units being big enough for families, recognizing that some of the numbers are hidden in here because there's some cultures where there's a lot of people living in a single unit who actually would otherwise be homeless or in a shelter. So it's helpful to know the numbers to see what progress we've made and to give us even more intent to continue working until we get this. I was very interested also in your discussion of supply and demand and that actually we'd have to have a lot more units before that would hold true. So we need to look, we need to carefully tailor it so that we encourage maybe not a lot of new housing, but rather retention of existing housing, which both for sustainability and for cost tends to be the most effective way of saving the planet and housing people. So that's something that I'll be looking for in the infill discussion we'll have next week. Thank you very much. Aye.
Fish.
Rent, we walk to work, and our average commute's about 10 minutes. So, and we're very grateful for that, to be honest. We probably used to spend 26 and a half minutes in a car, and it is a pleasure now to walk and come to work without all that stress. Kurt and Matthew and the team, congratulations. I thought last year's report was terrific. This one's even stronger. And I appreciate also the way you're incorporating graphics and other tools just to lead someone through it. Dan, your cover note rather modestly highlights all the accomplishments of the past year, and they are really remarkable collectively. Congratulations to your leadership. And yesterday the auditor released the community survey, and that document and this document tells a sobering picture about a city that is increasingly unaffordable to people. And I think we need to be clear that even with the historic efforts we're making, we are not going to overcome market forces that are swamping our city. So we're making progress. We are making investments for the long term, which will mean an inventory of housing that's affordable, but a tsunami is swamping us, and we do not have the capacity to change market dynamics. What we can do is mitigate those dynamics, and I think within the tools that we have, this council has made some significant progress, and thank you for your leadership. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I wish this report contained better news for residents of our city. And unfortunately, it doesn't. As it shows, rents are continuing to escalate. Home prices are going up. But I think it does show what is important is to be honest about how we're doing. And I think this does give us a very honest appraisal. And there are many things that we're doing that are very encouraging for the future. And I think it's just important that we as a city be true to what's going on out there. And this report is very fact-filled, so I want to thank, once again, Housing Bureau staff. I want to thank my colleagues up here and Mayor Hills. All of us worked hard to get this general obligation bond measure passed. And many people out in the community also worked very hard to get this passed. So we will make sure that those proceeds, with your help of appointing a good oversight committee, those proceeds are invested wisely and effectively. So thank you again. The report is adopted.
Excuse me, just before we close the testimony, I'm embarrassed that my math was incorrect. It's actually 41%.
I caught that.
Good, yes. Arithmetic was never my strong point. I was very good at calculus.
Yeah, no, we have a time certain at 3 o'clock, so we'll take a 5 or 10 minute break. Yeah.